who had the most difficulty getting in touch with their own personal problems were the ones that had the greater difficulty in getting through the curriculum. Someone asked me once what I learned most about, and my answer was myself.
Could you talk briefly about your experience studying under Dr. Huang Zu?
He was an incredible professor, and he was very gentle. His spectrum of knowledge about the traditional Chinese medicine was very comprehensive, and he had a way of just putting it across in a very easy way of understanding. And I remember one day he gave our class a list of 100 acupuncture points and told us to memorize it, and told us that if we knew the four factors involved with each of those points, as far as the neurovascular, the anatomical position, the primary function, and the innervation in the area of the point, that we would never have any problems.
In your life, you have served in various official capacities as president of the Acupuncture Association of British Columbia, Canadian Acupuncturist and TCM Alliance of British Columbia, and the Qualified Acupuncturist, as well as the TCM Association of British Columbia. Could you talk a bit about your experience working at such high levels to promote and lead the TCM profession?
It was something that I just sort of came into it in a natural way, because at previous times, I think the first time I remember being in charge of an association was when I was in grade school. I was elected president of my local 4-H club, and we had to learn about how to repair tractors and farm equipment and stuff like that. And during my time in sport parachuting, I worked quite extensively with the National Association there as a safety officer, a technical and training person, and I spent several years as a chief instructor examiner for the National Association. So when I moved on into traditional Chinese medicine, it was just kind of like a natural thing that occurred. My first involvement was as a student member back in the late 80s, when we were working with lobbying, starting to lobby the government as far as getting regulated. And I remember one weekend, a couple of my classmates and I spent our weekend faxing in a list of petition signatures. I think it was all together, it was about 6,000 pages that we faxed to the health minister of the day. And keeping in mind, this was long before we had computers and some of the other electronic equipment that we have in our everyday life today. When I got started, it was with the Acupuncture Association of BC, which was one of the first, if not the first, associations in the province. And it was a matter of working with the profession on a volunteer basis and providing whatever skill set we had available to us at that time to work with the profession and educate the public. And this is something that's an ongoing thread all the way through my other positions, was to make the public aware of the fact, the strength of traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture and how beneficial it can be. And unfortunately, we are still one of the best kept secrets in town as far as its healing potential.
What were your responsibilities as president in these capacities?
Of course, there's the leadership role, because you are sort of in charge of the other volunteers and encourage them to work to the best of their ability. And because it is a volunteer service to the profession, you have to respect the fact that people have their individual lives as well as their practice, and that any time that they spend volunteering is time that they take away from their family and their other life activities. I think the biggest thing with being a in that position is being a good listener and realizing that everybody has a valuable opinion as a leader, even though you may not always agree with other people's opinion, you have to listen to it and then make suggestions that will have a more positive outcome.
What challenges did you face working as president of these associations?
I guess since I don't speak Chinese, that was one of the biggest ones, although I found that I was quite well accepted by the Chinese community. So language was probably the largest problem, although, as I inferred, the Chinese people were always very accommodating, and they were very helpful as far as making sure that they translated conversations for me and things like that. And one of the other underlying situations is that even though there is a huge Chinese population in Canada and more specifically in British Columbia, although a lot of the Chinese people have immigrated, they haven't really integrated into the society. And it took a bit of gentle persuasion, I guess, to make people realize that they were now living in a different country with a different set of rules. And whether they liked it or not, those rules of their new home were the ones that we had to follow.
Did you ever face any criticisms for not speaking Chinese at such a high level?
Probably there were some people that were had their reservations. We used to have some fun with it occasionally. And as you probably know, the Chinese society is very exuberant, and I don't think that too many of them have ever read Robert's Rules of Order. That was a one aspect of it, managing the meetings that we had in a way that allowed people to voice their opinion. If there was any dissension as far as me not being able to speak Chinese, it wasn't presented to me directly. I just accepted the fact that I had the insight of being able to lead them in the right direction, even though I didn't speak the language.
You talk about any changes you made to the TCM practice and profession during your time as a president of these associations?
I think I helped them develop their organization in the sense of figuring out how to best deal with some government situations. And that was something that I learned over the years that we spent attempting to become regulated as a profession, and also my background in working for the government. It gave me some insights as to, you know, how to deal with different situations in regard to getting the government to understand our side of the discussion. And there were challenges. However, from my background in sports, I realized that you can't be a winner every day, and you just have to learn from the times when you don't always accomplish what you want and learn from those experiences and move on.
Were there any new policies or way of doing things that you introduced during your time as president?
Probably the biggest thing that I have always worked on is unification, in the sense of attempting to bring everybody together. And unfortunately, what happened, this is going back a long ways, with the Acupuncture Association of BC, they set very high standards for their qualifications of a member, even though this was in the pre-regulation days. They adopted basically the same standards as the state of California for qualification. And what occurred is when a person immigrated, if they were wanting to join the association, they had to prove their capabilities through a written test that the association had. And some of the Chinese practitioners that took, I guess, offense to that, in the sense that they felt that they were already qualified and they didn't really need to cooperate with a volunteer association to do what they wanted to do and felt they were qualified to do. And as a result, several of these individuals started up their own associations, and it it really slowed down the development and progression of the profession in the province, because instead of having one strong united voice, we had all these little factions. And it reminds me of the a little bit of the that old expression about the man who would be king. It was quite disruptive in a lot of ways to the overall development of the profession in the province.
What were some significant events or high watermarks during your time as president?
One of the things that we really strived for was continuing education. And as an association, one of our major events is that we participated in the Pacific Northwest Oriental Medicine Conference, or Chinese Medicine Conference, and we hosted that on a couple of different occasions. And we had attendees at this conference from basically all over North America. And one of our earlier members, Dr. John Stan, he has continued that on as a private enterprise. And he has an annual conference of Oriental medicine every spring. And he brings in very high-level presenters from all over the world that helps to elevate the level of skill set that the average practitioner has in the province. And we, as an association, under the current association, that's one of our key focuses as well. We offer our members a minimum of 25 hours of good quality continuing education every year, which is free to members. And this helps them meet the requirement of our regulatory college, which requires us to have 50 hours every 2 years of continuing education.
What was your vision during your presidency?
I wanted to see all of us become united, because there's strength in numbers. And the more you are scattered into smaller groups, the less effective we can be in lobbying the government and having the benefits of Chinese medicine accepted into the mainstream medical system within the province. So if I had to narrow it down to one thing, it would be to get everybody on the same page and all steering in the same direction.
And that was an interview with Dr. Bill Hartman, a doctor of Chinese medicine and political leader who has served in several official capacities of numerous TCM associations. In the interview, we talked about the responsibilities and challenges that Bill faced as president, as well as the changes, and significantly, Bill's vision for unity in the Chinese medicine community. This was also the last episode in this series of interviews with Chinese medicine practitioners in Vancouver. These interviews will be broadcasted again in May for Asian Heritage Month. They will also be available on SoundCloud in the coming future. Updates will await soon, and hopefully over the next few weeks you'll find them on SoundCloud. I'd like to thank you very much for tuning in and listening to these interviews. I invite everyone out there to explore the beautiful and efficacious healing tradition of Chinese medicine. Acupuncture and Chinese herbal medicine are a growing trend in Vancouver. And I personally believe that they are not just a trend. They're definitely here to stay, and these long-standing traditions are finally gaining recognition not only in the scientific community, but between the public, people like yourself and I. And there's no better time than now to get to know this medicine better. I hope what my series has sort of demonstrated is that there is a thriving community of Chinese medicine here in Vancouver, and There's no better time than now to, undergo a treatment or get some herbs or even talk to a practitioner, especially with all the regulation going on. Do your research, explore the Taoist principles of balance and harmony, and check us out. Anyway, thank you very much for listening.
is bird note. Spring has reached the Arctic. Low-growing wildflowers carpet slopes of tundra, and arriving migratory birds begin to sing. A sparrow-sized Lapland longspur perches atop a short stem, showing off his rich black-colored face, smartly outlined in rust and white. The longspur flaps upward 100 feet, then sings his languid song as he drifts slowly back to earth. Within low bushes, a tiny pale finch with pink breast and red crown sings buzzy, jingling trills, a hoary redpoll. Then, from a rocky outcrop, a flashy white songbird with black wings shoots straight up in the air before cutting loose his spirited phrases. This male snow bunting repeats his song flight every few minutes in his quest to attract a mate. Finally, we hear a song of insect-like trills mixed with whistles and buzzes. It's a beautiful male blue throat, his vivid azure throat and upper breast rimmed with rust. The song presses on and on. Spring has come to the Arctic. The birds' voices make it known. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
What do you think you might want to be when you grow up?
I want to be a veterinarian or an actor.
I want to be an engineer.
What does this look like?
It looks like an arrow with a straight line.
What about this one?
It looks like a scribbled line.
What drew me to science, I think, was the fact that it lets you explore the world around you. It sort of satiates your natural curiosity. And when I was small, I used to love to do stuff like go out into a big empty lot in the neighborhood and look for snakes, see what was alive in a puddle, capture tadpoles and bring them home and watch them mature. As I grew up, I just got more and more interested in poking around at the world around me. I think that's why I'm a microbiologist and a biologist to this day. You know, I started off poking squishy things in a pond, and now I just kind of poke smaller squishy things in the name of public health.
There's an amusing image of the route to success making the rounds on the internet. Perhaps you've seen it. It's often assumed that the route to success is a straight line, but for many it's a squiggly line of trying things out, dead ends, and detours. That's definitely been my own experience. So I'm quite intrigued by stories about others that don't necessarily follow straight lines. I'm fascinated by people that find careers they love from an unforeseen series of circumstances. One of those still embarking on an unexpected journey is Dr. Jennifer Gardy. Like myself, she's an alumna of both SFU and the Banff Center's Science Communication Program. She's an assistant professor at the School of Population and Public Health at the University of British Columbia. But you might also have seen her on television. This story is a window into her journey.
This is the nature of things.
We're constantly inundated with advice. Sugar makes children hyper. Brown eggs are healthier than white. We should drink 8 glasses of water a day. But are any of these true? I'm Dr. Jennifer Gardy, and I intend to find out.
Check. Good.
Level check, level check, check in a level.
Check. Good.
Level check, level check, check in a level. This is exciting. It's cool to do radio.
I wanted to start by getting you to go way back and maybe talk to me about when you were a little kid. Do you have any first memories of what you wanted to be when you grew up?
When I was a little kid, I had a career plan set out that was completely ridiculous. My plan was to be a doctor in the morning, a dentist in the afternoon, and then a ballerina at night. I don't know why I thought that I was capable of having three careers in a single day, every single day. But what's kind of interesting is looking back on that now, I see that the desire to do science was there, something sort of medical, health related, but at the same time, the desire to perform, to communicate was there too, had very early origins. I don't think my career trajectory is so much a trajectory as a random walk through an interesting landscape. I had always been interested in science and science communication, going back to when I was a kid and having this weird desire to be a doctor in the morning and the ballerina in the evening. But as I went through school, I became more and more focused on the sciences and more interested in biology and then microbiology. I hate to admit it, but a formative influence in my career was seeing Outbreak with Dustin Hoffman.
The greatest medical crisis of all time. We can't stop it.
Terrible movie, but really got me interested in infectious diseases. And I think maybe also kind of planted a bit of the seed that science communication is a thing. You can illustrate science, through Hollywood.
Many people are dying and are going to continue to die unless we find this monkey.
So with the infectious disease track, the sort of Dustin Hoffman thing in mind, I went to UBC as an undergraduate, ended up doing cell biology and genetics as a degree with a concentration in some bacterial and viral pathogenesis. So I was following the canonical sort of science script. And on the side, I was working at the campus newspapers, and this happened unintentionally. It wasn't me saying, oh, I really want to do, science communication as a career one day. I better equip myself with communication skills. It was me reading one paper in particular, this sort of satire paper put out by the Science Undergraduate Society. It was very much in the style of The Onion. I was reading it in my first year in between classes, and I thought, this paper is hilarious. These people would be fun to hang out with. I should go figure out where their office is and go say hi. So at the beginning of second year, I screwed up the confidence to go and introduce myself and say, hey, I like your paper. Can I help too? And the paper guys were like, this is fantastic. There's a girl here. We've never seen one of these in our office. Of course you can write for the paper. So worked with them for the rest of my undergraduate career.
After her undergraduate degree at the University of British Columbia, Gardy headed to McGill University in Montreal, where she pursued a graduate diploma in biotechnology. But there, too, she explored her dual career interests, finding an opportunity to moonlight at a newspaper, the Montreal Gazette. She returned to Vancouver to do a PhD at Simon Fraser University in computational analysis of microbial genomes. There, too, she found an opportunity to freelance, writing science stories for SFU News. And then,
through the SFU community, got to know Mark Winston, who had been a professor in biology, but at the time was starting up the Center for Dialogue. And he's a great science communicator. So I sat down and said, Mark, what do I need to know? Give me some advice. So we chatted and chatted and chatted. And he said, one of the things that I'm involved with, it's going to be starting at some point, but it's going to be this great program at the Banff Center in science communications. When it happens for the first time, I'll let you know and you should come. So that ended up happening for the first time in 2006, and I just finished my PhD and transitioned to a postdoc, again doing computational biology and understanding infectious diseases over at UBC. As my graduation present, my parents paid for my tuition to go to this Banff workshop. And while I was there, I had gotten to thinking, if writing about science is X amount of fun, then talking about it on television is probably 100x the amount of fun, if not even more orders of magnitude than that. So just harassed the faculty that was involved with television in any way, people like Jay Ingram and Henry Kowalski. I bugged them to the ends of the earth. I said, what do you need to do to get on science television? How do you do it? Give me scripts to practice. Watch me read this. Okay, what can I do better? Bugged them and bugged them and bugged them and bugged them. But it worked. Not too long after that Banff workshop finished, maybe about a month or two, CBC Television was looking for hosts for a new 8-part series that they had planned, a kind of spin-off of The Nature of Things. So I had a little audition video of me reading Daily Planet scripts that Jay had given me to practice. Sent it in, they liked it, did a callback audition in person where you had to kind of come up with an experiment and demonstrate it on camera. Got the job. And the thing about science television is once you do it once and you do it well, people just keep inviting you back to do it more. There's right. no sort of Craigslist job posting for TV hosts. It's all word of mouth. Now I've got this strange career where science communications is one thing that I do. Maybe about 20% of my time is devoted to it. And the other 80% of my time, I'm basically Dustin Hoffman in Outbreak.
Your town is being quarantined.
minus the helicopter chases, minus the, you know, trying to beg a hemorrhaging monkey to save America. It's a little more routine than that. It's a little more sort of meetings and just pushing data around than I expected. But yeah, I managed to achieve the dream.
Which aspects of your career have been unexpected?
Which aspects of my career have been unexpected? All of them. Every aspect, I think. I always sort of followed an opportunistic path rather than this sort of straight arrow trajectory. It was very much a winding road. What landed in my lap that seemed interesting at the time? Oh, let's go in that direction for a little bit. That happened in science. You know, my original goal was Dustin Hoffman in Outbreak, but I wandered through, you know, computational biology, cell biology and genetics, microbial genomics, immunology, information visualization. And then, only once I'd taken that very strange path did it all sort of coalesce into Dustin Hoffman and Outbreak, but built on this very odd, diverse set of experiences that kind of allowed me to, in my research practice, kind of create a new area of investigation and do something quite unique. And the same thing happened with science communication. It was always just following my nose from, hey, this campus paper looks like a fun place to work, to, oh, this magazine needs somebody to help them with their science. Sure, no problem. To, hey, look, CBC is looking for somebody. I should go in that direction. So I've never had a plan. I've never known what's next. I've never said, okay, this is where I want to be in 1 year, in 5 years, or 10 years. It's just, you know, see what the day brings, see what your network brings you, what word of mouth and opportunities sort of land in your lap, and follow the ones that look interesting. Don't follow your head necessarily, follow your heart. Your head will follow.
A big thank you to Dr. Jennifer Gardy for sharing her interesting story. And high fives to Tamsin Ogden and Clara Beckwith Jamieson, budding science communicators of the future. I'm Leslie Evans Ogden. Thanks for listening.
Are you interested in radio? Community-based media? You can join CJSF 90.1. We're a volunteer-run community radio station, and we always have space for new volunteers to become programmers, review music, edit audio, and so much more. All the training is provided and anyone can join. To volunteer, email our volunteer coordinator, Noel, at vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Again, that's vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Or you can visit our website, cjsf.ca. It's CJSF 90.1, diverse, independent, and yours. The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back, June 21st to the 25th. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, film, and art in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Featuring genre-defying indie alternative artist Barty Strange as guest curator, garage rock chameleons Osays, Chicago-based indie rock three-piece Dead, Latin folk innovator Helada Negro, Toronto's viral hip-hop sensation Akintoye, gothic folk artist Emma Ruth Rundle, alternative R&B hip-hop artist Amin D, and plus many more. There's 150 artists yet to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com.
Hi, we are Liars. I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.